From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today is Monday, September 13th.
When so many millions of Americans are not living up to their potential, America cannot live up to its.
That was New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who spoke to me about Biden's ambitious economic agenda. We'll dig into that a little later on, but first, your morning headlines. We begin with COVID. The U.S. passed a grim milestone of 41 million cases over the weekend, with 1 million new cases just in the last 6 days. While 380 million doses of the vaccine have now been administered, health officials are still struggling to convince the remaining population to get vaccinated, and that's leading to some shutdowns. Lewis County Hospital in upstate New York announced they will stop delivering babies at the end of the month after 6 staff members resigned, defying the hospital's vaccine mandate. Hospital officials say they don't have enough vaccinated employees to properly staff the maternity department, but hope the New York Department of Health can help them reopen soon. In another shutdown, major healthcare provider Intermountain Healthcare announced that 13 of its 24 Utah hospitals would be suspending almost all surgeries for several weeks as it deals with a surge of COVID patients. CEO Dr. Mark Harrison said that half the system's ICU beds are now occupied by patients with the virus, 90% of them unvaccinated. Next to Capitol Hill, where the Democrats' massive $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill is now in danger. The bill would expand federal health care, combat climate change, and invest in infrastructure. One of the key Democratic voters, Senator Joe Manchin, spoke out on CNN against the bill and the speed at which the bill is being pushed.
We've already put out $5.4 trillion, and we've tried to help Americans in every way we possibly can. And a lot of the help that we put out there is still there, and it's going to run clear until next year, 2022. What's the urgency? What's the urgency that we have?
Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders, one of the authors of the bill, shared his reaction also on CNN.
No, it is absolutely not acceptable to me. I don't think it's acceptable to the president, to the American people, or to the overwhelming majority of the people in the Democratic caucus. Look, we worked with Senator Manchin to pass the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. I believe we're going to all sit down and work together and come up with a $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill.
The bill would need all 50 Senate Democrats to pass. And finally, we end with the U.S. Open, where Novak Djokovic came up short in his bid to win all 4 major titles in 2021. It's known as a Grand Slam. His would have been the first in men's tennis since 1969. Daniil Medvedev beat Djokovic to secure the 2021 U.S. Open, the first major title of his career. In his winning speech, Daniil acknowledged the fans' disappointment of the match, but also went on to praise his opponent.
First of all, I want to say sorry for you fans and Novak, because, I mean, we all know what he was going for today. And I just want to say that, I mean, anyway, what, as you said, what you accomplished this year and throughout your career, I never said this to anybody, but I'll say it right now. For me, you are the greatest tennis player in the history.
And now to our daily deep dive. New York Times columnist and thought leader Nick Kristof has been writing about issues like poverty, education, women's rights, and immigration for 20 years. President Joe Biden promises to advance an agenda that many progressives, like Nick, hold dear. But can he succeed? Nick Kristof joins us today to share his impressions on the progress so far and the road ahead. Nick, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Rena.
So I want to talk to you about Joe Biden. He's had this ambitious plan of helping alleviate poverty in America. How would you rate Joe Biden's efforts so far?
In terms of ambition, I think it's enormously important and significant what he is doing. And I think of child poverty in America as one of the great stains on our country. And he has proposed a realistic chance to cut it in half. Now, will his plan succeed? Will it actually become reality? I think that's a lot less clear. If he were graded for effort, I'd give him high marks. But that's ultimately not what presidents are judged by. They're judged by accomplishments. And it's really too early to say on that front.
You call childhood poverty a stain on America. What do you mean for people who haven't been following this issue closely?
97% of Americans agree that there should be equal opportunity at the beginning of life. And that's extraordinary. 97% of Americans probably don't agree that the world is round. And yet the one thing that is very clear in the US is that kids don't have equal opportunity. If you try to explain how America became the dominant country of the 20th century, it has a lot to do with an emphasis on education. We were really the first country in the world to have nearly universal literacy, male and female. Then we were the first country to have very widespread high school education. Then the first country to have widespread college education. So as late as about 1970, we led the world in education. Now so many countries have gone past us. Last count, I think it was 24 countries have higher high school graduation rates than the United States does. If we don't graduate literate, numerate kids, that is tragic for those kids and it's awful for the country.
I know that you've been a big advocate for the child tax credit and moving that forward. You look at countries in Europe, they have had these tax credits for a very long time. This idea of reshaping policies that'll help families with childcare, universal pre-K, paid family leave, what kind of an impact could it have on American society and reshaping how we think about families and raising children in this country?
You're exactly right. And I'm glad you point to Europe because too often in the US, we tend to think, oh, it's too bad about some of these social problems, but they're a result of globalization or of technology. And the fact is, yeah, those are real issues. Globalization and technology and industrialization, they affect Germany, they affect Denmark, they affect Canada. And yet those countries haven't seen the kind of levels of child poverty that we've seen here. They haven't seen suicide rates reach a modern peak. They haven't seen life expectancy decline. And so while those issues are real, fundamentally, this is about policy choices that we as Americans make. And one of those alludes to the issue that you raise about childhood policy and whether we provide what Europe tends to call child allowances, what in this country are refundable child tax credits. So estimates are that they would reduce child poverty by about half in America. That would be huge.
That's pretty significant, Nick. Half is incredibly significant.
If we can help millions of children and get them on a better start in life so that then they're better able to succeed in school, better able to get good jobs, to form functional families, to avoid the siren call of drugs, then that is fantastic for them and fantastic for the country. And as a huge return.
You've done a lot to focus on women's rights and women's issues. I want to turn to Texas. Governor Greg Abbott has signed the nation's most restrictive abortion law into effect. I want to get your take.
Most Americans are neither always in favor of abortion rights or always against banning all abortions. They're somewhat ambivalent, and they do believe that there should be access to abortion in some circumstances, like rape, like incest. The Texas law, for example, would effectively bar abortion for people who become pregnant through a rape. There are very few Americans who think that is an ethical, moral decision. And so I think that it's worth cultivating that opposition and pushing back hard, because I think this is fundamentally about how Americans see this. And I think on that issue of rape in particular, Americans would be pretty horrified.
When you look at comprehensive immigration reform, which is such a complicated, sticky topic, very hard to wrap your hands around, let alone get passed through Congress, do you think in this moment, Joe Biden and his White House might be able to pull through a win in the next couple of years?
I think immigration reform is just about impossible unless the filibuster is ended. Democrats have just such a tiny threshold. I mean, a heart attack tomorrow in a Democratic senator would completely change the prospects for President Biden's legislative agenda. And, heart attacks happen.
There's a significant shortage of low-wage workers in a number of industries across America right now. Do you think allowing more immigration could help alleviate and solve that?
I'm here on a farm and farm country around here, and there is a desperate need for rural workers harvesting grapes, harvesting all kinds of things. And so the rural economy would certainly benefit considerably from that. There is a risk, though, that we import laborers as a way of keeping wages down in a form that perpetuates inequality. I think we should do everything we can to try to lift the skill capacity and education for a lot of low-wage Americans. And in some cases, that will mean that employers will simply have to pay more not that they will import workers and pay less.
Do you buy into this concept that American exceptionalism is on the decline at this moment?
I don't think I really do. I mean, America has certainly been humbled in Afghanistan. We were humbled in our handling of COVID-19 initially, but we've also shown tremendous strengths. I do think that in the long run, it is undermined, maybe above all, by our failures in education. I think the best metric for how a country will do in 25 years is how educated its people are, and not just those at the top, but maybe the bottom 25%. And by that metric, we are doing very poorly.
Well, we've got to take a quick break, but we're going to be right back with New York Times columnist Nick Kristoff on the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm joined by New York Times columnist Nick Kristoff, and we're talking about President Biden's ambitious plans to reshape American society. So when you step back and you look at the global issues around the world, what are the top three?
So I do think that climate change is an existential threat to our planet, and that has to generate much more attention. In terms of things that could really go downhill and create a huge crisis, I worry about U.S.-China relations. I don't think a war between the U.S. and China is likely, but is it possible? Absolutely. And that would be as devastating a conflict as one can imagine. And I would just emphasize the need for the U.S. to challenge the complacency on education and how many Americans are falling behind, are not being served by this system, and how many kids in particular are just falling through the cracks in ways that will hold them back. And, you know, when so many millions of Americans are not living up to their potential, America cannot live up to its.
I want to ask you about the book that you co-authored last year with your wife, Cheryl Wooden. The book's called Tightrope, America's Reaching for Hope. In the book, you followed around several of your former classmates in Oregon. What were some of the takeaways you got from the research from that book?
One was just the hopelessness in so much of America. The truth is that if you don't have a high school diploma, then you just can't access good jobs. And then what happened over and over to my friends, because they couldn't get good jobs the way their parents had, they self-medicated with meth or other drugs. They got criminal records. They became less employable. They became less marriageable. The family structure here collapsed. And this is a small rural town. We were very proud of our rural values and that social fabric that we were so proud of. It just unraveled. And there's a tendency, I think, in America to blame the victims and talk about how when people are poor, it's all about a lack of personal responsibility and bad choices. And there is no doubt that my old friends made some really bad choices, but they were on a trajectory to make bad choices from the time, you know, they were traumatized as kids by their dad beating them up or beating their mom up, by the time there was alcoholism in the house or addictions in the house, by the time they dropped out of high school and couldn't get a good job. And so I'd say, look, it's fair to have a conversation about personal responsibility. That's real. But let's also have a conversation about our collective social responsibility, especially to help kids.
When you talk about income inequality and those friends of yours who couldn't break the cycle, that's so much of America. How do you draw these people who need help the most, but just don't have the resources or the ability to get out of poverty?
So I think one of the lessons is that our best efforts have to be addressed at children in particular. It's not that we should give up on adults, but frankly, I have a lot of friends who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s and have spent decades wrestling with substance abuse. It's going to be really hard to help them. On the other hand, their kids and grandkids, we have a fighting chance to really help them and to break that cycle. And we should be working an awful lot more to do that. And the notion that a kid in one of those homes where they're witnessing violence, where there aren't any children's books in the home, where they aren't being read to, has the same opportunity as a kid in my home is absurd. And we can't make things, you know, exactly equal. We can do an awful lot better job of helping kids, supporting their parents, encouraging them to read to their kids, to reduce lead exposures. 500,000 American kids still suffer lead poisoning each year. These are big problems. We're not going to make them go away entirely. Can we mitigate them? Absolutely. And we should.
So, Nick, you've been at the New York Times for 20 years. During that time, you've been a champion for fighting poverty, inequality, supporting women's rights, health rights. You've won 2 Pulitzers. And now you're exploring a run for governor of Oregon. Tell me why.
It may be because I'm a little bit insane. So it had its roots when my wife and I were writing our last book, which was about the disintegration of the working class in the U.S. And it was told in part through the kids on my old school bus, a third of whom are now dead from deaths of despair. What I had not appreciated was the degree to which their kids and their grandkids, how their lives have imploded as well. And it just broke my heart to see. I have a job that I truly love. It'd be very, very hard to walk away from it. But it feels like I've been covering humanitarian crises in Afghanistan and Yemen and South Sudan. And meanwhile, my neighbors were suffering greatly, and I wasn't always there for them. And maybe I can do more for them. And that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Nick Kristof from the New York Times. Nick, so grateful to have you on.
Great to be with you.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. President Joe Biden begins a 2-day trip out west. He will survey the wildfire damage in Boise, Idaho, and Sacramento, California. He'll then join California Governor Gavin Newsom at a campaign event to help the governor's recall election on Tuesday. The president will end his visit in Colorado on Tuesday. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken will appear in front of the House Foreign Affairs Committee to answer questions on the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. The preliminary hearing for Virginia Giuffre's sexual assault lawsuit against the UK's Prince Andrew begins today. The prince is accused of engaging in sexual acts with Giuffre without her consent while he visited his friend Jeffrey Epstein, who Giuffre claims groomed and abused her. The suit states that the alleged abuse took place at the London home of Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell and at Epstein's homes in Manhattan and in Little St. James in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Have a great day, everyone. Hope to see you back tomorrow morning. This is the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Nicholas Kristof for being on the show. And if you like this episode, please subscribe to the Recount Daily Pod and do leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.